We'll watch for her first book, and we'll give you a year or two, okay, Sophia? We don't want to wait too long. Our next poet, I don't want to wait too long until he is president of the world, okay? Then we can call him President King! Okay, it's Brian. Where's Brian? Brian's
in the kitchen.
We just, you know... We spend so much time together over these 4 weeks. But again, I could say this about every student. I'll probably say it about every student. But I just wish, you know, I wish there were like at least 2,700 Brian Kings in the world with the heart of Brian King and the mind of Brian King and all those other things that we've come to love about Brian King. But seriously, his name is Brian King. He spelled Brian with a Y and not an I, and I don't know why. He says he's half Chinese and half white, and that once he took a semester off from school to go to China so he could get in touch with his roots. Okay? He skateboards. He skateboards around the Tour Eiffel here in Paris. He wants to be president someday so that people will have to address him as President King, and then somebody will think the president is actually a king, and then he'll have a son and name his son Martin and make him become a doctor, or he'll name him Joe, because he's not Joe King, all of these things. Brian says he's not a bit worried. He's not a bit worried about what he'll do with his life, because he thinks the future has quite a lot in store for him, and I think so too. Brian King.
Okay.
No, he's gonna be like really.
It's called not cobblestoned. The cobblestones, the goddamn cobblestones. I wander around all day on top of the cobblestones, and they are so old. Mostly, I'd like to tear up the cobblestone roads, and underneath, what would I find? If I tear up the carpet, I could find hardwood floors, but if I tear up the cobblestones, there's only dirt. I wander the dirt roads, but that isn't the same. Not nearly the same. So I will have to place each cobblestone back in place, one by one, until the dirt is entirely covered up again. I take off my shoes and the stones are cool, like me. They are enclosed by the buildings. Watching the sky as the clouds move on by and the two of us, myself and the cobblestones, feel jealous. The both of us wanting to be the clouds, to be able to look down upon ourselves, to look down upon the buildings, to see the streets and the people moving around. But now I just stand, my feet cool, so I close my eyes and try to dream. I don't feel so terrible because each cobblestone I now know, each one I've touched and put into place. One by one, they thank me for what I've done, and underneath, the dirt doesn't mind. And actually, they too miss the cobblestones. They were sad when I took all the cobblestones away. I didn't want to make anyone sad. All I wanted to do was to find out what was underneath. If I could, I would tear up every layer underneath the roads until there was nothing left to stand on, and all that there would be left to do is stand in place, like potted plants or 200-year-old trees or planets orbiting in the same space forever. Everything would stop, and nothing would move except for the clouds. They would continue to pass on by, looking down, dropping rain, and the clouds would not even know how we feel, alone down here. Unable to move, we are only able to think, and to look, and to feel the rain coming down onto us. The people stuck, the cobblestones stuck, the dirt stuck, and we would dream. Not of the future, but of the past. When the streets were in place and the city moved. Because you don't dream of the future, you dream of the past. And your dreams don't control you, you control them. In this city, Paris, is not the same anymore, until I put back each cobblestone, once again, one by one, and make the city turn on and run.
Yeah. Thank you. How are you guys doing back?
Woo!
Yeah!
Alright. This one's called His First and Last Visit to Paris. So, Hitler was at the spot where I skated in Paris, having a picture taken of himself in front of the Eiffel Tower, June 1940. Today, people sell miniature Eiffel Towers at the exact same place. I took a picture there 3 weeks ago from that same vantage point, but Hitler wasn't in it. Hitler is dead. He's been dead for almost 70 years. And if I look at his picture, and then the picture I took, and do this, back and forth, for the time it takes, till she loves me not, a petaled flower, it is almost like his shadow is there in my picture. Hitler arrived in Paris at 5:30 a.m. on June 23, 1940. Hitler visited the Opera House, Les Madeleines, Place de la Concorde, Champs-Élysées, and the Arc de Triomphe. I did the same thing 25,874 days after he did it. Since he visited Paris and I visited Paris, one major thing has changed. He is dead, and a minor thing as well. I was born. Now when I go back to skate near the exact place his picture was taken, I'll have my picture taken and hope that his shadow doesn't show up when it gets developed. Unless when he killed himself, he forgot to shoot his shadow too. I might buy a miniature Eiffel Tower from the man selling them, unless he decides to pick up his sack to run away from the police officer who wants all of his souvenirs much more than I do, and to give him a big fat ticket. A lot happens in 70 years, but our pictures will still look the same. Across the Seine, on Trocadero Esplanade, with the Eiffel Tower in the background, sticking out like a flag in the ground that says, "Welcome to Paris." Yeah. Alright, so I'm going to preface this one a little bit. I think it pretty much sums up me as a person. It's inspired by Baudelaire. One should always laugh. Laugh at yourself until you run out of laughs, until your tummy turns into a sixer, and then invite everyone to your mixer. You should all drink and laugh and then laugh harder until your laughter is passed along among everyone in the room, until the entire city is laughing, and they will all be laughing with you. And when you see that girl bat her lashes at you, just smile and laugh until she smiles and laughs right back at you. You should laugh so hard that it makes you fall down onto your face, and with your face cut up and bloodied, you will see everyone looking and laughing at you. It's a joke, and after a toke, you will feel better, and then you laugh again, because now everything is funny. Your hands are funny, and your feet are funny, and you laugh when you think about Easter and all those uneaten, melted chocolate bunnies. Laugh at yourself, and if you can't laugh at yourself, then there's nothing you can laugh at. You should laugh when you drive alone in your car, when you turn on NPR, and Lakshmi Singh says her name. It's like she is laughing right next to you. Laugh silently and laugh loudly, and laugh when you read, laugh when you write. Modest Mouse was right, and I laugh when Isaac Brock shouts, "Laugh hard, it's a long ways to the bank." And you should laugh until you can't laugh anymore. You can't laugh at all until someone bumps into you. Someone you knew from some long time ago. They choke when they try to say hello, and they laugh, and the next thing you know, you're laughing too, and there I am, laughing, saying, "I told you so." Thank you.
Thank you, Brian King. Our next poet is Rosaline O'Sullivan. I love that name. We sometimes call her Rose. Is she hiding? Okay. Yeah, because Rose said public speaking is among her greatest fears. So be really, really nice to her when she comes up here. Throw flowers. Soft money. She was born... Soft money, yeah. Rose was born in California. She went 48 hours without a name. A number of students in this class didn't have names. Didn't have names when you were born.
I just got my name yesterday.
Okay. Rose has gone skydiving and bungee jumping. She's been stranded on top of a volcano in New Zealand, but she's too scared to try to drive in Paris. Although she loves Paris, and Paris loves her. Here's Rosaline O'Sullivan.
Okay, so I'm going to start with the social issues poem that we did from Ellen Hinsey's workshop. It's called Deepwater Horizon. God knows when a sparrow falls, knows the ooze and muck of every hour of these 2 months of sorrow in the Gulf. Our accidental tar babies flounder in shallow waters, straining to breathe, the sticky silt of the dark drain depths enveloping strong and weak. What black Pompeii have we built at the bottom of the sea? This is our industrial Atlantis. The myth we feel if we cannot see. Let the lesions bubble up on our earth through the plants and the birds and the beach. Let the disease rut and ravage and rave until it reaches the corporate ladder where the untouchables shit and sleep. It's for Matthew. It's called Control. My lips follow the lines of little pills through the months of each year. We are orange 3 weeks, then green. We are the ghastly neon green of tainted things, and I spill blood. I wonder aloud in the doctor's office, as the backs of my bare knees crinkle the paper, whether or not there might, maybe, be side effects of which I should be aware. Better than being pregnant is the crisp and unanimous reply, to which there can be no rebuttal. So I slurp up my little friends with milk, popcorn, cola, vodka, whatever I might be consuming at 9:30 p.m. on the dot. And I do not want a baby. I am scared of their wide-eyed stares. the silly putty gums and inquisitive tongues wrapped around little, stumpy fingers without nails. But even my securely altered womb can't stop me thinking of those chubby cheeks sinking into what should have been chins. I fear the gaping jaws of those pretty, pill-bought babies, the grotesquely innocent faces of our omnipotence. And this one was our Lirvert poem, which was about drinking. it's called Coincidence and Other Difficulties. I have been catching non-contagious problems recently. My sister's gastritis. Her spasming knee. A broken watch from my roommate last week. Hers lost all sense of time. Mine simply fell to pieces. Last week, I played my game. In a taxi with an amicable West African man behind the wheel, we hit 35 euros on the freeway, and I decided I will not pay more than 60. I would not pay more than 60. I would not pay more. We hit 50 as we got lost upon the Esplanade. Still, I would not pay more. Arrival home, 59.80. Add 20 cents for a tip, and not a cent more. Some people like to play games in their heads. Some people like to play games in other people's heads. Some people don't want to know that there are games being played at all, but they do.
Everybody likes to sit back because here comes Andrew Ramirez, okay? He takes his, takes his whiskey with water, knows how to make a dog laugh, donates blood because he likes orange juice and Fig Newtons. He's an amazing performer, an amazing poet, an amazing young man from El Paso. Okay, so we can all sing the Marty Robbins song from El Paso, Texas. Here's Andrew Ramirez.
Okay. Got two poems. This one's called Motherfuckers.
Oh, dear.
Hear me out. Hear me out. Hear me out. Okay. Motherfuckers. Be always a motherfucker. So as to make all the other fuckers in the room go, fuck. So as to draw lines of people at your door, singing rants at your door, so as to inspire a wealth of resentment, a bevy of emotion, a bloody axe of excitement aimed at the flex of your motherfucking neck. Be always a motherfucker, do not be anything else. Do not be smitten to listen or praise, to follow or graze in the grass nurtured green, by gardener shit. Why, Mr. Writer, Mr. Painter, Mr. Viola Player, or Senor Lovemaker, would you choose to soften your hard edge, round out your sharp point, stretch loose your taut rope with too many thank you ma'ams and yes sirs? Instead, take off your shirt and jam that sweet loveliness face down in the dirt. Be always a motherfucker. Be always a motherfucker, leading crowds by the hand in the direction of free meals in their homes, not yours. Free drinks on their dimes. One feast upon another among a feast of friends slathered in freedom. Write poetry like you know it. Paint canvases like you know it. Pool on bottles, drag on someone else's cigarettes, and glide on dance floors like you've always known it. Take whatever small, microscopic talent you might have by the neck and don't ever stop squeezing. There are jacks of all trades and there are masters of none. And then there is you, a motherfucker, giggling in the back room with the sweet, pretty blonde nun. So sit in another person's chair, drink someone else's wine, scream obscenities into the air, and as others listen and stew, and inevitably becoming more and more disgusted by you, wait for the older woman to walk in,
Wait for the noise to be sucked of all blood. Wait for someone to say, "Hey, fucker, I'd like you to meet my dear old mother, Lorraine." This one's called... No, I didn't bring it.
Oh, okay.
This one's called The Mailman. Well, I'm still getting them by the dozens. Big, heavy letters belted by twine. In the mail, where the letters have accumulated in my box over the months like marbles. Someone says, "Where do they come from?" I say, "I don't know." "What do they say?" "I don't know." Someone says, "Who pays the postage on these?" And I say, "Okay, let's hand me one, let's see." That's how it was on the line. There's a midnight mailman out there with hyena eyes on pills, stealing other people's mail and putting it in my box, I'm pretty sure. Last week I got one with a return address, Hinesville, Georgia. I got some more that say Santa Fe, New Mexico, Augusta, Georgia, Denton, Texas, Barrington, Illinois, and Camarillo, California, that one in calligraphy. I've looked up the addresses on all these spots, but they're all closed down. Coffee shops and rest stops, restaurants with names like Irma's and Dorothy's, Elva's and Kenny's, Mauricio's and Senor Leonardo's. I visited the places in person to make sure, but it's no use. All these coffee shops and restaurants have been vacated and destroyed, as if laid into with bombs. The windows have been made into slants of glass, held in their frames like guillotines. The roofs have been punched with holes that leak sunlight and rain, wind, and the shadows of the hawks and buzzards that circle overhead. The paint peels off the walls in eyelash curls and falls through the air into the weeds. But there's a sound, too, screaming through the trees, a sound, too, that crawls across the fields, a sound that resonates from the highway, groans over hidden streets, a sound that reminds me of the in-progress invasion of the mailbox I've left defenseless back home. Someone says, "Why don't you just open one of them?" And I say, "Are you crazy? Haven't you seen where these letters come from?" And someone steps from a shadow, smiles, takes a knife from the cutting board, and slips it through the sealed fold. "What are you doing?" I say. "Can I do it?" someone says. And I rush and dial the police, but the telephone is a vacuum on my ear. "It won't hurt," someone says, cutting. And I say, "No," laughing, choking. "Don't you know what a federal offense is?"
Andrew Ramirez. Thank you, Andrew. I think we have three poets.
Yeah.
Four more poets. Diana Rosenberger says she's the most unathletic person you will ever meet. She started her career by forging notes to get out of PE class in high school. Okay? It's been, you know, I'm just not going to. She's done too many illegal things to run for public office. But she knows some Chet Baker solos by heart, and that's what matters to me. Okay? She's also addicted to Sam Cooke and the Everly Brothers. She yells at the television when she watches football. She swears. She dances. She writes beautiful poetry. Here is Diana Rosenberger.
Okay. This one is to my great uncle and his sisters. Not so long ago, the world was at war. Pomerania belonged to the Third Reich, and Bruno was the darling of the German army. Bruno's sisters were beautiful, twins, one fat, one thin, but both liked to eat. Bruno fought in Russia. He saw the scalp of Russia. He picked at its dirty, lice-ridden head. He tore the Soviet strands of hair from their icy follicles. He scraped the enemy's blood from his fangs. Bruno's sisters were named Christine and Hilda. When Germany flung open the doors of Prague, they pirouetted in like ballerinas. They studied medicine. The men called them the Pomeranian ladies. They gorged themselves on the feasts of Czechoslovakia. Bruno was not swallowed by the gaping mouth of the Urals. His was a story of survival. He ascended the slipping mountains, digging his heels into Bolshevik stones, one after the other, after the other. He did not know what was at the top. When the Germans lost, Christine and Hilda surrendered their feasts. They were sent to a civilian POW camp in Russia. Hilda does not like to talk about it. Christine says she would not have survived had Hilda not shared her already meager portions. Christine was the heavier of the two, but the meat on her body was worthless. It froze and then melted off her hips, leaving nothing but tendons. Hilda's slim body froze to steel. Bruno scaled the Urals. At the top, he found the Pomeranian ladies feasting only on snow. Okay. This one's called September. Okay. It is not until 10 years later that I say, tell me. Tell me about the day that plumes rose like black lady fingers swallowed in the bathtub sky. Tell me about the John Grisham novel you were reading in the square, your last folded page corner in the shadows of iron. Tell me about the people running down Broadway, past the abandoned hot dog stands, past the screaming pavement. He tries to speak. His lips are wet with poetry. He had always been a poet. He told me once the Beatles were like prophets ambling through the vinyl. He told me once the dandelion was like a pat of butter from the angels. He told me once I played the piano like his mother sprinkled pepper on her eggs. I hated the piano like I hated milk and Mondays and batting ninth on the softball team. But that day the ivory gorged itself on my sweat. I played minuets until you came home. He tries to speak. His lips are wet with poetry. But all that comes out of his mouth are the ashes that covered his suit. The same ashes he crushed into the welcome mat when he sank into the front door. He coughs up fuselage and final phone calls of people we would never know. He tries to speak, but his lips are wet with tears. Mm-hmm. This last one's it's a postcard poem, and it's a little more lighthearted, maybe. And it's addressed to my dad, and I don't know. It's my Paris poem. So, okay, Dad. I know that you took her to Sacré-Cœur because you told me that I had to go to Sacré-Cœur. I know that you stayed with her at the Hôtel de Bastille-Louanais because you wrote it in an email you sent to me this morning. But there is another place in Paris, a place that you may not know, a place where it smells like marble and laughter and every line is the first line of a poem, where the evening is not pink but musty and flaxen, where the Eiffel Tower slices the plane of the sky like a Y-axis, iron and ugly, a steely reminder of the warmth of my companion's banter. A place where the bateau mouche rolls below like some kind of lovemaking whale, and we get so distracted that we almost ash the cigarettes in our wine bottles. where there are domes and gold and joggers, beautiful joggers, with their milky cotton clinging to their sweaty abdomens, where the people look far more like her than like you. You two probably would have liked it, but then again, I'd rather not know.
Diana, though I don't know if I'd call that last one more lighthearted.
I don't know.
But gorgeous poems. The September poem is really, really beautiful. Diana Vaden, another Diana. We had a Diana and a Diana. It depended on who was first, whether it was Diana or the other Diana.
Diana as well.
Diana as well. Was raised to consider herself buried treasure. I think that's a really good idea for Diana Vaden. When I first had Diana in a class at USC, Matthew Cruz, I think it was Matthew who looked at her and said, "You were on, so you think you can dance." You recognized her immediately. She was. She was. She almost sold her soul to a reality TV show, but they didn't want her soul. They said it was too green. Okay. Good. All right. I don't know what else to tell you about Diana Vaden. She's an amazing poet, amazing dancer. She does all kinds of things that we don't even know about yet, but we will. Here's Diana Vaden.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Okay. This first one is a postcard from a cafe in Paris. Rue de la Boucherie, which is near here, is here. This is the street. Okay.
Oh, this is here.
Anyway.
Oh, wait, it's near here. It's so close that it's here.
So across the way, a young waiter stands under a red awning. His arms are crossed. He slouches. He fidgets. He speaks to an old man sitting nearby, who is still. Only his mouth moves. They speak for just a moment. Then the young waiter disappears into the cafe. The old man pushes his beer forward, offering it to a ghost. His bag sits where his bride used to be. He stands, glass half empty. Then he leaves, taking his bag by the handle, leading it home. "I'll bring you here one day," ask the waiter who fidgets with his arms crossed, "for the table under that red awning. And in a language you do not yet understand, I'll order one glass of wine. Then I will leave it half full and push it towards you. We will finish what was started here, I promise." Okay, the next one is called Blaze. "You, with your skin of burning lilacs, with your shoulder blades smoothed, trembling, carved with feathers and halo. You, with your wide button warm leather chest, with your vast marble lungs. You with your canopy voice, with your rope thunder and tar cannon spine. You with your whispering thighs, with your waist of melted gold coins and childhood brawls, with your storm-buckled knees, with your fingers of cast-iron railway. My love, with your wrists of dark porcelain mugs, with your veins like rivers of coffee I lap up with my tongue." And the last one is called "A Full Glass of Red Light Instinct." Paris, France. 1. Slender cafe creme fingers stroking a thick base of glass. Long unpainted nails clink against the bottom, full of "come hither church bell rhythm these libertine hands haven't prayed in a while." 2. Requiem eyes full of hazelnut jazz search for blues in the glass spine. Low vibrato rasp in the throat. A palm unforgiven tucks under the chin. Jazzy heat-seeking things blink back Ellington. Waters as dark blood rushes in. Smell the saxophone in the oak. Hear the bass on its breath. No organs in the cherry. Just keys of forget. 3. Satiny taste buds chit-chat with swish knives like hot prismatic strobes in the cabaret bar. That slippery tongue sinks into the noise of deep spank-me hallelujahs. Lips touching rim with pole gripping size. 4. Here's to you, midnight. Finger slither, eyes moan. More Cabernet and oh merci. A soaked whisper, monsieur, the tip will be me.
That's it.
She told her that's where she should just stop. Brian's like going like this with his sweater down. I don't know if you noticed that or not. You were having that effect on him.
Oh, thank you. Oh.
One more poet of our student poets. I hate to see this 4 weeks come to an end. I hate to say au revoir to all of you. But here we are at our last and not least poet, Leslie Wasserman. Who, what can I tell you about Leslie? She doesn't like walking behind slow people, neither do I. So we walk really well together. She's a figure skater. Okay? She doesn't always tell people that. She's Jewish, but she loves Christmas. She's a vegetarian. She's been a vegetarian since she was 14, which was not all that long ago, Leslie. I hate to tell you. I could make a nice introduction of each of these poets by reciting their criminal records, other than Sophia, who's only guilty of not being able to wink and having never had a nosebleed. Otherwise, she's completely innocent. But Leslie was escorted off of a tram in Poland for being an anarchiste, as my Polish friends would say, for riding without a ticket. She's going to adopt some children. She's afraid of squirrels, mice, rats. She hates birds and cats, but she's okay with spiders and cockroaches. She likes chivalry, so be chivalrous. Here's Leslie Wasserman.
Yay. Yes. Okay, first one's called Compromise. Unfortunately, your penis fucks like a fluorescent light. 7 espresso seconds and sadly your marble lips smother mine. Your arms swarm my frustratingly dull river of hair. My knees unspool, ambivalent to this suicidal sexual saunter. The bed groans, desperately desiring flight from this room, this apartment, this apocalypse. Poor bed, witness to cigarette sex and charred thighs. And you translate my woes and no's into yeses, but messes manage to graze like flocks of oxen, nibbling like gnats and piercing as mosquitoes do, deep into my ankles, my fingers, my temples. Stop that, you sinister serpent. I am swimming this mundane backstroke better than any Olympian. You are my black sea, inhuman. You tear apart my trafficked eyes. You discard my imprisoned smile. You neglect my vacant ears. You bid adieu to the revolting stamp you leave, tattooing on me an irreparable, irreversible Roman numeral. This place, lacquered in gin and tonic, fosters sadists. It nurtures sewage breath, where rats have spawned. Mold takes residence, flies immigrate too. You accept the contentment of being life's understudy, the unpleasures of flesh. An empire state in extinction of happiness reigns over leather-bound wisdom and whiskey. But I, the weeping willow, continue to cry. Tears of absolution, tears of ash, tears of thorns. Vibrant disaster floods through the walls, gray. Plastic screams break my veins, swallowing misery, vomiting shadows. And I can't even remember the motherland of the dead. All right. This next one... it's a really lame title, but it's called Love.
So lame, Love.
Sorry.
Oh, God.
Okay. There's something in language where to be becomes being, is, am, are, were, been. But I can, you can, he can, we can, they can. And none of it makes any sense, seeing that every word is capable of being lost, although it never is. But is communication even necessary to communicate? Because there are hundreds of ways to say something simple. My love is unconditional. You complete me. I can't live without you. What happened to I love you? For Anya, and for Vani too, these words were not so easy. She was from Poland, and he from Italy. For her, water is pronounced water, and the word the has never existed. For him, guide is greed, and every sentence ebbs and flows like a ballad. But language was not important. It was dialogue versus behavior, love without communication. For them, there was an attraction, a deep attraction, a volatile attraction, that lasted for 3 years. And for those 3 years, it was only Anya's heart that ever broke. You are a special girl in my mind and my heart, but it is true that I am not looking for a relationship right now. I cannot explain why is that. I guess at the moment I just need it. And Anya never said anything, and Bonnie never knew how hurt she was, never knew how she longed for a relationship with him. But she always agreed to keep things casual. She lied to herself and to him, but mostly to herself, because what she didn't want was to lose him. Until the night when Anya had too much to drink and she wasn't afraid of Vani. She didn't fear his rejection and she didn't hold back her words or her tears. You were first guy who ever made me cry and I am scared that I would fall in love with you at one point. And Vani was quiet and Anya went on. I really need someone to be next to me what I need him. I have no idea how long would it last because as you know, I am getting bored pretty easily and I change my mind all the time, but I want to try. And Vani remained quiet, ashamed and regretful and guilty, but she didn't stop. I don't want to destroy what it is between us, but I also do not want to be used. I feel like toy in your hands. Mm-hmm. And he stared at his hands, Leimani that had once touched her arms and her back, her hands and her neck and her face, and he knew they never would again. And she continued, I know that sometimes it's hard to understand what sits in my head, but this is how I feel right now and for last few months, so it's time to change something. Anya felt relieved. She never knew how easy it was to just speak to him, to communicate in the only language they had in common, this middle ground, a language of function, diplomacy, efficiency, neither person in their native tongue, any importance on verbs and tenses and structure withdrawn. They did not matter. It was feeling, it was emotion, it was Italian without romance, it was Anya's broken heart, her Zwammani Serce. The wound was open, and so was she. And she waited for him to say anything, anything, any one thing, anything at all. And he said, I feel like you should know that I agree with you in everything that you say. I owe you an apology, more than one, for my behavior. Vani knew finally how much he had hurt her. How much she had cared about him, how much he had cared about her, but not in the right way. I haven't been enough considerate of you, and I really feel sorry. And Anya began to cry, because she knew exactly what he was saying. It was now. Now she understood more English than she ever had. I'll try to be a better friend than I was able to be a lover. And Anya only cried harder. I would finish there because that was a really long poem. However, yesterday my bubby died, which bubby is Yiddish for grandmother. It was really unexpected, and the funeral is Sunday, and I'm in Los Angeles, and I'm unable to be there. And I just want her to know that after 8 times of her telling me to go, I finally made it to the Clooney Museum. And it makes sense to me why she was the only person who ever told me to go there. So this poem was written after I went to Normandy. During the war, my bubby lived in Chicago selling war bonds while she kept in touch with my grandfather, who was stationed in the South Pacific. It's called Private E2, Undistinguishable. Here rests in honored glory a comrade in arms known but to God. Nobody knows I came from Little Rock, Arkansas. Nobody knows I was 19 in 2 days the day I kissed my mother goodbye and patted my little sisters on their heads. Nobody knows I went to basic training in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Nobody knows that my father died in a plane crash and he's buried in Roselawn Cemetery on the Barton Park side. Nobody knows that at 10 years old I became a father to my sisters. Nobody knows that I kissed one girl, Hazel, behind our barn, and only behind our barn. Nobody knows that I wrote to Hazel once a week and never received a response. Nobody knows that I hated arithmetic but loved chemistry and literature. Nobody knows how much I loved Herman Melville and that I'd read Bartleby 4 times. Nobody knows I was accepted to Yale. Nobody knows my eyes were blue and I had a freckle under my left. Nobody knows I saved a drowning cat in the Arkansas River near Riverview Park. Nobody knows that I would have married Barbara Stanwyck, but I was in love with Hedy Lamarr from Algiers. Nobody knows that I wanted to see Paris, Barcelona, Amsterdam, and Prague. Nobody knows that I was my mother's only son. Nobody knows that I walked my eldest sister down the aisle at her wedding. Nobody knows that I coached football to 10-year-olds. Nobody knows that I helped my mother cook supper every Wednesday and Sunday. We filled the kitchen with parsley, thyme, and laurel. Nobody knows that I liked cooking, especially rouladen and spätzle. Nobody knows that I milked the cows and fed the chickens, and that I hated killing animals. Nobody knows that I was terrified of dying. Nobody knows I was scared shitless the day I got my draft letter. Nobody knows how badly I wanted to fake poor eyesight to get out of it. Nobody knows that my parents were German immigrants, that I spoke German and could have translated instead of fight. Nobody knows I get seasick the minute I stepped on a boat. Nobody knows I hated the sight of blood. Nobody knows where I died or where I'm buried. Nobody knows how much I loved my sister and how much I loved my mother. Nobody knows that my name was Walter.
Once more, I'd like to say thank you to Brian King, Andrew Ramirez, Corrine DeWitt, Jessica Eller, Diana Rosenberger, Cordelia Arterian, Sophia Kang, Matthew Cruz, Diana Vaden, Rosalina O'Sullivan, Kelly Barton, Leslie Wasserman, Kelly Barron. I'm changing your name to Kelly Barton. Thank you also to Suzanne Allen, who has been videographing, videotaping. Of the scenes. I have asked if Heather Hartley would grace us with one poem, and while she decides what she's going to read, I'm going to read one last poem, a Paris poem, and I was going to threaten to read. See, there's a book right there. She's going to read. It's been a wonderful, wonderful 4 weeks. Thank you, Paris, for having us. We will be back. We will return. Shine. In such dark times, we all need to shine, each to each with what light we have, as dusk like a smoky curtain falls from east to west across the world, and the world grows dim with news of war, and the headlines blacken our fingertips, and the wicks of candles burnt to char. Among these monuments and shadows, friends, let us suffer our radiance. In this city in which I once loved my beloved, in hunger, the brasseries shine, and the neon of Saint Michel casts a glow like dawn on the ancient walls, and the wine in our glasses, ruby and bright, and the teeth of the waiter when he smiles, and our voices like coins in our throats, and our laughter silver as ever, and all our tears useless and beautiful. Shine. And the Seine gleams darkly past, dragging its net of drowning stars, and the half-moon, tarnished gold, slides through the ragged map of clouds, and somewhere the sky being torn into sheets of flame and shrieking shines. And the paving stones shine beneath the clatter of our heels in the courtyard's hush, and the window of one room, blue, glows in the loneliness of its night, and the flickering light of the TV screen buzzes and shines with its shining lies, and our reflections thrown back from the glass, our ghosts in the gilt-framed mirrors, shine, and our prayers, which are nothing, shine, and the bones of the dead in the earth's black loam, and the flowers on graves with their dumb, sweet tongues, and my wedding band, small and gold, still whole, and the whole bloody planet glimpsed through the eye of what God may yet squint through the stars at us, shines. Thank you to everyone for reading this evening. You guys, amazing. I'm sorry I had to leave for part of the time of your workshop, but please give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you. Wonderful.
I'll read the title poem. Knock, knock. It starts off with an epigraph by one of my preferred authors in the world. When in doubt, I go to this person. It's anonymous. They're never wrong. You can always count on them, you know. You're not quite sure, so it's by anonymous. It's fine. And it's, the quote is, he laughs little but makes others laugh. His fork outlasted his fuck. His landlord was the king of butter. His confidant, the local barber, he had a bitchy page. Drank bitter bitters. Knew a senator who couldn't masticate. Saw Padua from a pension. Serenissime. There's a powdered wig and a mask involved. A wayward monk in a wooden spoon. An Amazon in an auberge. Macaroni, clitoris, ink. A dictionary of cheese. Candle wax and dead skin. Flakons and tinctures and blancmange, a singular gondola, the Kabbalah, a woman with yellow roses in her gloved hands. Someone's at the servant's door. Someone's at the porte cochere. Knock, knock. Who's there? Casanova.
Okay. Mingle with the poets. They'll sign autographs. They don't have Diana, don't you give me that look. They're here. Buy books from Shakespeare and Company.
And if you could also, your chair. Fold up your chair if you can.
Fold up your chair if you can.
Please, that'd be great.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.